The French foreign minister observed that Leopold's only failing is that he cannot hide his intelligence. One gets suspicious and afraid of being led up the garden path. The South African diamond king, Cecil Rhodes, the one other white man whose boundless reach in Africa matched Leopold's, once joked that he had declined an invitation to a meal at the palace because each dinner accepted cost a province. At Laeken, servants were used to seeing the king's large, bearded, bald-headed figure with its severe brown eyes and big nose, dressed in a lieutenant general's uniform and walking for hours, leaning on his oak cane among the palm trees and other tropical plants in the greenhouses and on the paths of the chateau's large park. His eccentricities multiplied. Sometimes he rode to rendezvous with Caroline on a large tricycle, which he referred to as Mon Animal. He still feared germs and became convinced that it was good for his health to drink huge quantities of hot water each day. Servants kept a decanter always at the ready. Court protocol remained as formal as ever, the tone set by Leopold, who spoke slowly and majestically, as if, Joseph Conrad and Ford Madox Ford wrote in their thinly disguised portrait of him in their novel The Inheritors, he were forever replying to toasts to his health. Leopold had also begun speaking of himself in the third person. Bring him some hot water, call him his doctor, give him his cane. The command he really wanted to give was, don't take away his Congo. For thanks to Morel's campaign and his own Commission of Inquiry report, from all sides pressure was mounting on him to divest himself of the country he considered his private property. Only one alternative to Leopold's control of the Congo was ever really considered. It's becoming a colony of Belgium. Even Morel, frustrated by the lack of other politically viable choices, reluctantly advocated what was known as the Belgian solution. If such a move were accompanied by the proper reforms, and Morel constantly insisted on these, he believed the rights of the Congolese might be better protected in a Belgian colony open to scrutiny and under the rule of law than in a secretive royal fief. That few reformers considered anything but the Belgian solution seems surprising to us today, but we forget that in the first decade of the century the idea of independence and self-government in Africa was voiced by almost no one, except for a few beleaguered rebels deep in the Congo rainforest. In 1890, George Washington Williams had called for the Congo to be under rule that would be local, not European, international, not national. But it would be more than three decades later before even the most ardently anti-colonialist intellectuals in Europe, Africa, or the Americas said much like this again. To Leopold, the international explosion of bad publicity triggered by the Kowalski disaster was a turning point. Instead of grandly bequeathing the Congo to Belgium at his death, as he had planned, he understood that he would have to make the change before then. With his extraordinary knack for making the best of an apparently difficult situation, he began to manoeuvre. If these do-gooders were forcing him to give up his beloved colony, he decided, he was not going to give it away. He would sell it, and Belgium, the buyer, would have to pay dearly. Oddly enough, Leopold had the Belgian government cornered. The Congo reform movement had reached such a pitch of fervour that Belgium's international reputation was at stake, and the British public's capacity for moral outrage had a power independent of government. At about this time, for example, some British humanitarians were organizing a boycott of Portuguese products because of Portugal's use of forced labor in Africa. Furthermore, if Belgium didn't take over the colony soon, some powerful country might. France and Germany, long jealous of the king's lucrative rubber profits, had their eye on pieces of Congo territory. President Roosevelt hinted that he was willing to join Britain in convening an international conference to discuss the Congo's fate. Three times the British and American ministers in Brussels went together to see the Belgian Minister of Foreign Affairs and press for Belgian annexation. But sharply limited as Leopold's powers were in Belgium itself, the worried Belgian government had no legal authority over him in his role as ruler of the Congo. In the end, the king held the key cards, and he knew it. How much, then, could he get the government to pay him for his colony? Negotiations began at the end of 1906, but soon bogged down, because the government could not get an accounting of the secretive Congo state's finances. If you are buying a business enterprise, after all, you want to see the balance sheet. Leopold was wintering in the sun at Cap Ferrat, and the government dispatched the Secretary-General of the Foreign Ministry, Baron Leon van der Elst, to see him. The king received the baron on his yacht, showered him with hospitality for several days, and showed him through the gardens of his expanding array of properties on shore. But when the baron asked for financial data, Leopold replied that the Congo state is not beholden to anyone except to its founder. No one has the right to ask for its accounts. One reason for his obstinacy, it became clear when auditors finally got to see some numbers, was that the 25 million francs the Belgian government had loaned him in 1890, plus nearly 7 million more he had borrowed a few years later, were missing. An Antwerp newspaper suggested that the money had gone to Caroline. The king huffed and puffed and deflected further questioning. Negotiations dragged on through 1907 and into early 1908. Leopold grumped and raged at the officials who tried to talk with him. At one point, he slammed the door in his secretary's face, accusing him of being in league with the forces trying to take away his Congo. But, like his charm, the king's tantrums were calculated. With the time that they bought him, he secretly did everything possible to hide his bewildering web of Congo-related riches, all the while claiming that he had no such wealth at all. I am the ruler of the Congo, but the prosperity of the country no more affects me financially than the prosperity of America increases the means of President Roosevelt, he told an American correspondent. I have not 1 cent invested in Congo industries, and I have not received any salary as Congo executive. Finally, the king hinted that he was ready to give in. He named his price. He yielded a little, but not much, and in March 1908 the deal was done. In return for receiving the Congo, the Belgian government first of all agreed to assume its 110 million francs worth of debts, much of them in the form of bonds Leopold had freely dispensed over the years to favourites like Caroline. Some of the debt the outmanoeuvred Belgian government assumed was in effect to itself, the nearly 32 million francs worth of loans Leopold had never paid back. As part of the deal, Belgium also agreed to pay 45.5 million francs toward completing certain of the king's pet building projects. Fully a third of the amount was targeted for the extensive renovations underway at Laeken, already one of Europe's most luxurious royal homes, where, at the height of reconstruction, 700 stonemasons, 150 horses, and 7 steam cranes had been at work, following a grand Leopoldian blueprint to build a center for world conferences. Finally, on top of all this, Leopold was to receive, in installments, another 50 million francs as a mark of gratitude for his great sacrifices made for the Congo. Those funds were not expected to come from the Belgian taxpayer. They were to be extracted from the Congo itself. In November 1908, as solemn ceremonies at Boma marked the Congo's formal change of ownership, an unusual drama was unfolding far inland. The mere fact that it had begun under Leopold's state and continued uninterrupted in the new Belgian colony suggests that the difference between the two regimes was not what the reformers had hoped for. At center stage was the black American missionary William Shepherd. Shepherd's article from a decade earlier about his discovering 81 severed hands being smoked over a fire had been one of the most widely quoted pieces of testimony about the Congo. His eyewitness account, writes one scholar, was cited by almost every American reformer, black or white. For some years now, Shepherd had had a strong ally in his boss, William Morrison, a white minister who had headed the Southern Presbyterian Congo Mission since 1897. Morrison was a fearless opponent of the regime, a friend of Morrell's, and a leader in inspiring his fellow missionaries, American, British, and Scandinavian, to speak out. He had bombarded officials in Boma with letters of protest, published an open letter to Leopold, and delivered an influential speech when passing through London. In the United States, he had led a group of Presbyterians to see President Theodore Roosevelt about the Congo. The regime, in turn, hated Morrison as much as it did Shepherd. Shepherd and Morrison were the most outspoken of any of the American Congo missionaries, whose protests had long nettled Leopold. He had ordered missionary magazines searched for their hostile articles. Some copies still survive, heavily marked in blue pencil by palace aides. Leopold could not get at his real target, Morrell, safe in England, but he had tried persistently to intimidate Morrell's sources. In 1906, he had issued a decree mandating a fine or a 5-year jail term for any calumny against a Congo state official. A British Baptist missionary who fed information to Morrell was soon put on trial. He was convicted, fined 1,000 francs plus court costs, and, less of a crusader than Shepherd or Morrison, he left the country. The little band of American Presbyterians saw it was now riskier to speak out. The authorities were watching them closely, both in Africa and abroad. The little band of American Presbyterians saw it was now riskier to speak out. The authorities were watching them closely, both in Africa and abroad. Unknown to them, Monsieur, the Belgian minister to Washington, had attended in Virginia one of the many headline-making speeches denouncing Congo atrocities that was given by Shepherd, whose reputation for stirring oratory packed many a church or hall during his home leaves. As the end of Leopold's rule approached, the Compagnie du Kasaï, a concession company of a new generation that was the de facto government of the area where the Presbyterians were working, was trying to extract all the rubber it could while the boom lasted. The Kasai River Basin, where exploitation had begun a little later than elsewhere, had become the Congo's most lucrative source of rubber. And who now suddenly reappears on the scene, visiting the area for some months as Inspector General of the Compagnie du Kasai, having risen in the world since we met him last? Léon Rom, the one-time collector of severed heads. His transformation into a Congo Company official was a common one for retired force publique officers. In the Kasai region, the normally unwarlike Kuba people had risen in revolt against the rubber terror, spurred on, as in similar doomed uprisings elsewhere in southern Africa, by elders with a fetish said to change the white man's bullets into water. The rebels burned trading posts and a mission station. When bullets did not turn to water, some 180 of them were killed. Writing in the annual newsletter the American Presbyterians published for their supporters back home, the Kasai Herald, William Shepherd described the toll taken on the Kuba. Significantly, he first celebrated the Kuba's history, writing in a way that no white missionary would have done. These great stalwart men and women, who have from time immemorial been free, cultivating large farms of Indian corn, peas, tobacco, potatoes, trapping elephants for their ivory tusks and leopards for their skins, who have always had their own king and a government not to be despised, officers of the law established in every town of the kingdom, these magnificent people, perhaps about 400,000 in number, have entered a new chapter in the history of their tribe. Only a few years ago, travellers through this country found them living in large homes, having from 1 to 4 rooms in each house, loving and living happily with their wives and children, one of the most prosperous and intelligent of all the African tribes. But within these last 3 years, how changed they are! Their farms are growing up in weeds and jungle. Their king is practically a slave. Their houses now are mostly only half-built single rooms and are much neglected. The streets of their towns are not clean and well swept as they once were. Even their children cry for bread. Why this change? You have it in a few words. There are armed sentries of chartered trading companies who force the men and women to spend most of their days and nights in the forests making rubber, and the price they receive is so meagre that they cannot live upon it. In the majority of villages, these people have not time to listen to the gospel story or give an answer concerning their soul's salvation. Shepherd's story appeared in January 1908, the month Léon Rom returned to Belgium from a 6-month business trip to the Kasai. Soon after, Rom's colleagues at the Compagnie du Kasai began to threaten, bluster, and demand a retraction, which Morrison and Shepherd refused to make. Morrison sent company officials forceful letters listing more specific charges, which upset them still further. The two missionaries were legally vulnerable, since technically they had published the article in the Congo itself. In England, Morel reprinted Shepherd's article, and also a photograph the missionaries had sent him of forced labourers tied to one another by ropes around their necks. While the company was still complaining about the offending article, the British vice-consul to the Congo, Wilfred Thesiger, paid a 3-month visit to the Kasai Basin to prepare a report on conditions there. Nervous officials monitored his travels, remembering all too well the international furor caused by Roger Casement's report 4 years earlier. To the authorities' dismay, Thesiger stayed with the American Presbyterians at their mission and travelled on their steamboat, the Lapsley. As someone who understood the local languages and who knew the district well, Shepherd acted as guide to Thesiger, taking him to 31 Kuba villages. After they departed, a suspicious station chief grilled villagers the two men had spoken to and worriedly reported to his superiors that Shepherd pointed to the consul and said, "You see this white man? When he returns to Europe, he will tell the state officials whatever you tell him, because he is very powerful." In the Bakuba villages, Thesiger asked any questions Shepherd suggested. Thesiger soon submitted an excoriating report on starvation and brutality in the Kasai to the British Parliament. One passage describing Kuba homes falling into ruin while people were put to work as rubber slaves closely echoed Shepherd's article. The Compagnie du Kasai's stock price plummeted. Company and Congo state officials, furious, blamed Shepherd. The company could not legally punish the Presbyterians for helping Thesiger, but it could do so for their publishing Shepherd's 1908 article. In February 1909, it filed suit for libel against Shepherd, as writer of the article, and Morrison as its publisher, demanding 80,000 francs in damages. The two men, firm in their convictions, decided that if the judge ruled against them, they would, as Morrison wrote home, prefer to go to prison rather than pay the fine. Abroad, their supporters rallied to their defence. Morrison in the dock, wrote Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, ignoring the black defendant Shepherd, makes a finer Statue of Liberty than Bartholdi's in New York Harbour. In Washington, the affair was discussed at a cabinet meeting. The American legation in Brussels informed the Belgian government that the United States viewed the trial with acute interest and no little concern, and suggested that U.S. recognition of the new Belgian claim to the Congo might hinge on the result. The trial took place in Leopoldville, some 600 miles down the Kasai and Congo rivers from the Presbyterian mission. A photo shows Morrison and Shepherd before the trial, standing under some palm trees on each side of a dozen Kubas who were prepared to testify in their defense. The Kubas are naked above the waist. Morrison, the white man, looks resigned behind his heavy beard, as if preparing for one more ordeal in a saintly life that will be rewarded in heaven, but certainly not before then. He wears a black hat, black suit, and scuffed shoes. Shepherd, the black man, wears a white suit and white hat. His shoes gleam, his chest is arched out. He stands a head taller than everyone else and seems to be enjoying the moment immensely. There is something proud and inclusive in his stance toward the Kubas, as if they are junior kinsmen. The trial's opening date was set, deliberately, the missionaries thought, during the dry season on the Kasai River. After the steamboat carrying the two defendants and their Kuba witnesses encountered low water, the captain refused to go farther. A new date was fixed. Morel telegraphed his friend and ally, Emile van der Velde, leader of the Belgian Socialists, asking him to recommend an honest young Belgian lawyer for the two missionaries. Van der Velde, a leading figure in European democratic socialism, was also an attorney. To everyone's surprise, he declared that he would take on the case himself, pro bono. The trial was postponed yet again so that van der Velde could travel out to the Congo. As he was preparing to leave Belgium, someone criticized him for traveling all the way to Africa to defend a couple of strangers. Unspoken, perhaps, was the fact that one of those strangers was black. Van der Velde replied, "No man is a stranger in a court of justice." Newly arrived in the Congo, the anti-clerical van der Velde, president of the Second International and friend or acquaintance of all the great left-wing figures of his day, found himself living in a mission station and cruising Stanley Pool in the mission steamboat, which flew the American flag. He watched with great amusement as missionaries carried out baptisms by total immersion and prayed for a favorable verdict. At last the trial began. In a Leopold courtroom of wood and brick, its windows open to the breeze. On a technicality, the court had dropped the charge against Morrison, leaving Shepherd the only defendant. In this frontier outpost, dotted with mango, palm, and baobab trees, and with its forced labor gangs, military barracks, and a firing range where Europeans practiced shooting on Sundays, the trial was definitely the biggest show in town. Over 30 foreign Protestant missionaries packed the courtroom in a show of support. They and other supporters of Shepherd sat on one side of the courtroom. On the other side were the Catholic missionaries, Congo state officials, and other backers of the Compagnie du Kasai. Onlookers who couldn't fit in the room watched through the open door and windows. The Compagnie du Kasai officials wore white suits and white sun helmets. Shepherd looked natty in a dark coat with a handkerchief in his breast pocket. After the judge rang a small bell to begin the proceedings and the lawyer for the Compagnie du Kasai spoke, van der Velde rose to make the most of his unusual forum. Shepherd, he told the judge, was no longer of England or America, but of the Kasai. His only motive in revealing the condition of the natives amongst whom he lives is humanitarian. Van der Velde made a magnificent defence, Morrison reported. His speech was a marvel of eloquence, invincible logic, burning sarcasm, and pathetic appeal for justice to be done not only for us missionaries, but especially for the native peoples. He held the audience in the courtroom spellbound for over 2 hours. Shepherd, the accused, was also moved. "The trial is the talk of the whole country," he wrote, "and the spectators were so affected that their handkerchiefs were freely used." According to Shepherd, even the Catholic priests, usually staunch allies of the state, were weeping, and one of them came up and congratulated Van der Velde after his speech. It is said there has never been such a speech as that made in Congo. The trial won Shepherd some attention back home. Under the headlines, "American Negro Hero of Congo" and "First to Inform World of Congo Abuses," the Boston Herald wrote, "Dr. Shepherd has not only stood before kings, but he has also stood against them. In pursuit of his mission of serving his race in its native land, this son of a slave has dared to withstand all the power of Leopold." After the closing arguments, the judge announced that he would give his decision in 2 weeks. In the end, it was politics, not Van der Velde's eloquence or the missionaries' prayers, that dictated the results. The presence of the American Consul General and Vice Consul in the courtroom was a reminder of the problems Belgium might face if Shepherd were found in the wrong. Similarly, the judge knew he would not have a promising career in the Congo if he found that Shepherd's accusations against the company were true. Steering a cautious middle course, he made adroit use of the fact that, even though there were no other such companies in the area, Shepherd's article had not specifically named the Compagnie du Kasaï, but had only attacked armed centuries of chartered trading companies. Thus, the judge declared, most improbably, the defendant Shepherd did not intend to make an attack on the said company. The article did not and could not refer to the Compagnie du Kasaï. In effect, Shepherd was found innocent without the Compagnie du Kasaï's being found guilty. The company, however, had to pay court costs. Far up the Kasaï River, the missionaries' wives knew that their husbands had vowed to go to jail rather than pay the damages if the judgment went against them. The sign that this had happened would be if the men were not on board the Presbyterian steamboat when it returned from Leopoldville. As people anxiously awaited at the mission station, there seems to have been a warmth and camaraderie among these black and white Americans that would have been inconceivable back home. "Mrs. Morrison and I waited almost breathlessly for the return of our loved ones," wrote Lucy Gant Shepherd. "As the Lapsley came steaming in, hundreds of Christians began singing hymns and waving their hands and shouting for joy. It was a glorious time, a time for thanksgiving." Back in Europe, there was no thanksgiving for Leopold. In December 1909, less than 2 months after the Shepherd trial, the 74-year-old king fell gravely ill with an intestinal blockage, possibly a euphemism for cancer. Crowded out of the Chateau of Laeken by his endless renovations, surrounded, as always, by sheaves of architectural drawings, the king was living in an outbuilding, the Palm Pavilion, amid the great greenhouses. Caroline and their 2 sons rushed to Leopold's side, and Leopold's private chaplain performed a hasty wedding. With things now straightened out with the church, the king could receive last rites. Nonetheless, Caroline, who stayed by his side, had to disappear from sight every time a visitor arrived. Leopold's rejected daughters, Louise and Stephanie, came to Brussels hoping for a reconciliation and for changes in their favour in the royal will. Obstinate to the last, their father turned them away. The royal physician, Dr. Jules Thiriard, who had also served as a dummy stockholder for the king in several Congo corporations, ordered an operation, but it was unsuccessful. Parliament had just passed a pet bill of Leopold's instituting compulsory military service. When he came out of the anaesthetic after his surgery, the king signed the bill with a trembling hand. The next day he seemed to rally, demanding newspapers and giving orders to prepare for a departure for the Riviera. A few hours later he was dead. One of the myriad of hovering officials led the weeping Caroline from his bedside. If we are to believe Caroline's account, Leopold, just after the secret wedding, had turned to Baron Auguste Goffinet, one of the plump, bearded, slightly cross-eyed twins who had been among his closest aides for more than 30 years, and declared, "I present to you my widow. I place her under your protection during the few days she'll spend in Belgium after my death." It is likely that the king did say something like this, for he knew that his three daughters and the Belgian public hated Caroline, and that they would do so all the more when they discovered that in his last days he had transferred to her a fortune in Congo securities, on top of some 6 million francs he had already given her. Princess Louise's lawyers came after the securities, so when Caroline went to her Brussels villa, she found it padlocked and guarded, the windows boarded up. It was the same story at the French castle she had been given by Leopold. But with the help of the king's loyalists, who were seen removing papers from his desk in his final hours, Caroline got herself and much of her money away to Paris. Less than a year later she remarried, her husband none other than the former French officer Dorieux, her original boyfriend and pimp. If she shared some of her fortune with him, his was surely one of the most successful feats of pimpery of all time. Of Caroline and Leopold's two sons, one died a few years after his father. The other lived a long, quiet life on the income from capital once wrested from the labor of Congo rubber slaves. He died in 1984. Perhaps the most interesting of Leopold's descendants was his granddaughter Elizabeth, the only child of Stephanie and Crown Prince Rudolf of Austria-Hungary. She married a socialist politician and became known as the Red Archduchess. At his death, Leopold was little mourned by his people. They much preferred his nephew and successor, Albert I, modest, likable, and, extremely rare for a European monarch, visibly in love with his wife. As for the world outside Belgium, thanks to Morel and his allies, it now thought of Leopold not in terms of the monuments and buildings he was so proud of, but of the severed hands. The American poet, Vachel Lindsay, declaimed, "Listen to the yell of Leopold's ghost, burning in hell for his hand-maimed host. Hear how the demons chuckle and yell, cutting his hands off down in hell." But the battle over how Leopold and his works would be remembered had only begun. The life of a major figure in the early stages of that battle, Roger Casement, had now taken some new turnings. When Casement's report was published, he had been interviewed by newspapers, wined and dined by the London literary world, awarded a medal by the British king, attacked by the Belgian king, defended by Morel and the reform movement, and then vindicated triumphantly by Leopold's own commission of inquiry. But Casement had to earn a living. By 1906 he was once again serving as British consul in a remote spot, this time Santos, Brazil, where the consulate was an empty, whitewashed room in a coffee warehouse. He wore a dress uniform for ceremonial occasions, white gloves, gold braid on collar and cuffs, a sword and a hat with a cockade. But his daily work was anything but glamorous. Exasperatedly summing up his entire consular career, Casement later wrote, "My predecessor in Santos had a wire netting up to the ceiling to prevent distressed British subjects throwing things at him. At Delagoa Bay, in Mozambique, I could not afford a secretary or clerk. I had to sit in my office for 2 years and open the door to everyone who came in. I was bottle washer and everything else. I have known ladies to come in and ask me for their cab fare. I have been asked to pronounce a divorce and been upbraided for not doing it. Once a woman came into my office in Delagoa Bay and fainted on the sofa, and that woman remained in the house for a week." When he was not bailing drunken sailors out of jail or performing other consular duties, Casement was becoming ever more involved with his native Ireland. On home leave, he met members of the movement to revive what he called the lovely, glorious language of Gaelic, and with it the roots of Irish culture. He visited the movement's language school at Clochanilly, where he was photographed, arms crossed tightly on his stomach as if holding in some anxiety, his tall frame seated awkwardly amid solemn Gaelic League members in long Victorian cutaways and vests. "In those lonely Congo forests where I found Leopold," he wrote to a friend, "I found also myself, the incorrigible Irishman." To another, he said that, "It was only because I was an Irishman that I could understand fully, I think, the whole scheme of wrongdoing at work on the Congo." He had come to feel that Ireland, like the Congo, was a colony, and that there, too, the core injustice was the way the colonial conquerors had taken the land. "I realized that I was looking at this tragedy in the Congo with the eyes of another race of people once hunted themselves." True enough, but was the race of people once hunted themselves only the Irish? Being a gay man in an unforgiving age, Casement surely felt hunted every day of his adult life. That was a cause too dangerous to openly take on, but embracing Irish nationalism was possible, and Casement did so with characteristic passion. Although he never fully mastered the language, he sometimes used the Gaelic form of his name, Ruairi MacCasmond, and tried Gaelic in his letters. On his way to take up his post in Brazil, his baggage stuffed with books on Ireland, he wrote to a friend, "Remember my address is Consulate of Great Britain and Ireland, Santos, not British Consulate." He had special stationery printed to emphasize this. From Brazil, he wrote home, "Send me news of Congo and Ireland. Nothing else counts." On one trip home, his ship anchored at Rio de Janeiro. Casement came ashore, and we talked for a time before going back to his liner for lunch, the British vice-consul later recalled. Halfway out to the ship, the villainous Brazilian boatmen who were rowing us out suddenly rested on their oars and, as was often their wont, tried to hold us up for more money than the price already agreed on. But by then, Casement was launched on a tremendous monologue about Irish home rule, and nothing could stem the flood. For a while, the boatmen tried to shout him down, but it was impossible. Finally, they gave up in disgust, and we continued on our way, with Casement still going strong on Ireland. Generous, as always, he helped support a ne'er-do-well brother for some years, and frequently in debt, Casement somehow managed to contribute more than £85 in payments to Irish causes in 1907 out of his salary. More and more, he came to see the world in terms of colonizers and colonized. His letters are filled with discomfort at working for the biggest colonizer of them all, and he gently chided his friend E.D. Morrell for believing England to be morally superior to the other colonial powers. "I have no use for your British government. You are one of the few, my dear bulldog, who do not realize the national characteristics, and it is for that I love you. When I think what J.B., John Bull, has done to Ireland, I literally weep to think I must still serve instead of fight. I do not agree with you that England and America are the two great humanitarian powers. They are materialistic first and humanitarian only a century after." Morrell advised Casement not to sacrifice his pension rights by prematurely leaving the consular service. He understood Casement's frustrations, but was wise enough to know that some of them came from the man, not the job. "You are a difficult man to help," he once wrote to Casement. "You are very proud, for which I admire you in the first place. Also, forgive me for saying so, it is a little difficult sometimes to know exactly anything that could be done that would fall in with your exact wishes." Casement worried about Morrell's welfare as much as Morrell did about his. He knew that Morrell, having poured all his energy into Congo reform, had not been able to put aside any money for his old age. In London, on leave, Casement began collecting funds for this purpose, contributing £50 himself. "My hope now," he wrote to William A. Cadbury, the Quaker chocolate manufacturer, "is that we may raise from £10,000 to £15,000, possibly, and with this sum invested for the wife and children, the besetting fear and dread that weighs on his mind may be removed forever, and his whole personality released for greater good and more work for Africa or elsewhere where such a fearless soul as his is needed." Casement followed this with a blizzard of letters and personal visits to other Congo reform supporters. He fell short of his target, but he succeeded in gathering several £1,000. He, and Morrell even more so, were skilled at something essential to political crusades, fundraising. Suddenly, an opportunity arose for Casement to repeat his famous Congo investigative journey, this time in another part of the world. Reports filtering back to England described atrocities committed against Indians in the remote Putumayo region of Peru by officials of the Peruvian Amazon Rubber Company. British humanitarians, labor unions, and church groups were demanding action. The firm was incorporated in London, and some of the mistreated workers were British subjects, contract laborers from Barbados. The Foreign Office sent Casement to investigate. For Casement, the Putumayo was the Congo all over again, from the long, dreary journeys on crowded steamboats to the swarms of rainforest mosquitoes to the shootings, shackles, beheadings, mutilations, and kidnappings of a slave labor system driven by Europe's insatiable demand for wild rubber. Casement weighed and tried to carry the Indians' rubber loads. He measured the stocks into which people were locked to be flogged with a tapir hide whip which resembled the chicot. In reporting to the Foreign Office, Casement knew everything had to be precise and well documented. But his other writings from this time show a romantic idealization of the oppressed. The Irish, he felt, were white Indians. Poverty-stricken Galway was the Irish Putumayo. In a magazine article, he argued that the Putumayo Indians were morally superior to their white overlords. The Indian was a socialist by temperament, habit, and possibly an age-long memory of Inca and pre-Inca precept. Some of the smaller peoples crushed by their armies might not have seen the Incas so benignly. Despite succumbing to his own version of the noble savage myth, Casement got the job done. As with the Congo, he was not content just to carry out his Foreign Office assignment. He wrote voluminous letters to influential people, raised money, and fed pages of suggested questions to sympathetic members of Parliament. In the middle of this work, he received a startling piece of news. On recommendation of the Foreign Secretary, he was to be knighted. He agonized for days over whether to refuse the knighthood, feeling, as he explained to a friend, that until Ireland is safe and her outlook happy, no Irishman has any right to be accepting honors. Finally, he said yes, but when it came to the day of the actual ceremony, which would have required him to kneel before the British king, he pled ill. While in the Putumayo, Casement's life had been all work, as in the Congo, with scarcely a thought for anything else. But on the long voyages to and from South America, he filled his diary again with a record of assignations. On shipboard, Captain Stewart, an Indian boy of 19, broad face. In Para, Brazil. Shall I see João, dear old soul? I'll get up early. To cemetery, and lo, João, coming along, blushed to roots of hair with joy. He seemed to become more heedless in his meetings. Passing through Para again, dinner at 8 p.m. and out to cemetery and met friend. Police passing behind paling, but he laughed. $10. Still undiscovered, the time bomb's fuse burned on. One evening in 1910, a year after King Leopold died, London theatre-goers attending a new play based on the Sherlock Holmes story The Speckled Band noticed a trio of men in the audience, the famous journalist E.D. Morell with his trademark moustache, the black-bearded Sir Roger Casement, deeply tanned from his time in the Putumayo, and the creator of Sherlock Holmes, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, host of the other two. Conan Doyle was Morell's most important new recruit to the cause of Congo reform. His help was eagerly welcomed by Morell, whose job had been made more difficult by the Belgian takeover of the Congo and Leopold's death the following year. Morell had suffered the worst setback that can happen to a crusader. He had lost his villain. It is always tempting to believe that a bad system is the fault of one bad man. Morell never gave in to that temptation, but he feared that his supporters would. For the Congo reformers, being able to demonize Leopold had been a double-edged sword. With the king now gone, the movement could easily falter, so Conan Doyle's influential support had come at just the right time. In 1909, the novelist had spoken side by side with Morell to huge crowds, 2,800 in Edinburgh, 3,000 in Plymouth, 5,000 in Liverpool. He wrote an introduction to Morell's newest book, and also published a book of his own based on Morell's vast store of material, The Crime of the Congo, which sold 25,000 copies a week when it first appeared and was immediately translated into several languages. With all the fervour of a late convert, he was one of the few people in Europe whose denunciations were even more impassioned than Morell's. He called the exploitation of the Congo the greatest crime which has ever been committed in the history of the world. Morell considered the Belgian takeover of the Congo only a partial victory. He knew that the system Leopold had set up would not be quickly dismantled. It was too profitable. The same men who had been district commissioners and station chiefs for Leopold would now simply get their paychecks from a different source. The Force Publique didn't even bother to change its name. The new Belgian Minister of Colonies was a former official of a company that had used thousands of forced labourers to build railways in the eastern Congo. The head of the Belgian Senate Committee that approved the new colonial budget, which increased taxes in kind on Africans, Morell pointed out, was a shareholder in the notorious rubber concession company ABIR. As long as there was big money to be made from rubber, white men, with the help of the gun and the chicot, would force black men to gather it. Coached by Morell, Conan Doyle wrote, in one of many letters to the editor he sent to various British newspapers, "So long as in any report of Congo reforms such a sentence occurs as, 'adult natives will be compelled to work,' there can be no true reform whatever." Morell now concentrated on trying to make the Foreign Office demand that the Belgian government eliminate the hated Leopoldian system of forced labour and confiscation of the products of the land. The final picture in the Congo Reform Association slideshow was of a British warship, which Morel urged be sent to Boma to block the Congo River. Earl Grey, the Foreign Secretary, refused, limiting his pressure on Belgium to withholding British recognition of the Belgian Congo. Morel threw himself into his organizing with more intensity than ever, turning out another book and an undiminished stream of pamphlets, articles, and issues of the Congo Reform Association's magazine. He packed the Royal Albert Hall to the highest balconies with a huge Congo protest meeting, endorsed by 20 bishops and 140 members of parliament. Change seemed to be on its way in the Congo. The new Belgian king, Albert I, who had actually visited the territory just before taking the throne and seen people without hands, let it be known that he thought forced labour a scandal and lobbied for major reforms. He would lose his youthful idealism later in life, unfortunately. Morel was delighted, but such news made it hard to keep his followers fired up. By 1910, the American Congo Reform Association had faded away. Americans, Morel wrote to one of his hundreds of correspondents, have not got very much staying power. Morel tried valiantly to keep his followers focused on the issue of land ownership, so much more important but so much less dramatic than Leopold's personal villainy had been. He had long believed that the root of the evil will remain untouched till the native of the Congo becomes once more owner of his land and of the produce which it yields. Although Morel never intended it to be, his vocal insistence on African land rights was taken by many people, particularly in the Foreign Office, as implicitly threatening not just to Belgium but to British practice in Africa. "The native question is not so simple as he thinks," the Foreign Secretary wrote to Lord Cromer, a Morel supporter. "We do not, in our own colonies, say that all the land and produce of the soil belongs to the natives." In believing that Congo land did belong to the Africans, Morel was inherently more radical than almost all of those he worked with. Once again, Morel the Crusader for Justice was in unspoken tension with Morel the British Patriot, whose newest celebrity ally, Conan Doyle, had once been president of the Boys' Empire League. In Morel's writings of this period, we can begin to see signs of how his involvement with the Congo had changed and deepened him. In 1909, decades ahead of his time and in stark contrast to the self-congratulatory mood around him, he wrote a trenchant warning of the far-reaching consequences over the wider destiny not only of South Africa but of all Negro Africa that would flow from the fact that Britain had set up the new independent Union of South Africa with an all-white legislature. All did not look bleak to Morel, however. In the fall of 1909, the Belgian colonial minister announced major reforms to be phased in over 3 years. Morel strongly protested that the transition period was too long. But over this time, letters from his missionary correspondents turned hopeful. Similarly encouraging news came from inspection tours by British consuls. Reports of atrocities against rubber workers slowed to a trickle. In 1912, Alice and John Harris, now running the newly merged Anti-Slavery and Aborigines Protection Society, returned from a trip to the Congo and reported immense improvement. Morel was locked in a double race against time, against the inevitable British recognition of the Congo as a Belgian colony, which finally came in 1913, and against the waning fervour of his supporters. Even Casement felt that the breakup of the pirate stronghold was nearly accomplished, and urged Morel to declare the campaign over. Despite some doubts voiced in his private correspondence, Morel decided to publicly claim victory. "I do not wish to paint the present in roseate hues. The wounds of the Congo will take generations to heal. But the atrocities have disappeared. The revenues are no longer supplied by forced or slave labour. The rubber tax has gone. The native is free to gather the produce of his soil. A responsible government has replaced an irresponsible despotism." The one major goal not achieved, he acknowledged, was African ownership of land. On June 16, 1913, the Congo Reform Association held its final meeting at the Westminster Palace Hotel in London. Many of the principal British supporters of the cause were together for the last time. John and Alice Harris, the Archbishop of Canterbury, explorers, missionaries, editors, MPs, Sir Roger Casement, William Cadbury, John Holt, Emile van der Velde, Pierre Mille, and the writer John Galsworthy sent letters or telegrams of support that were read aloud. as the organization he founded, which had roiled the political waters of several countries for nearly a decade, officially went out of business, E.D. Morrell was only 39 years old. A series of distinguished speakers praised him. Morrell seldom liked sharing too much of the limelight, but when he replied on this occasion, he gave the greatest credit to someone else. While I was listening to all that was being said, I had a vision. The vision of a small steamer ploughing its way up the Congo just 10 years ago this month, and on its decks a man that some of you know, a man of great heart, Roger Casement. The meeting marked the end of the first major international human rights movement of the 20th century. "We have struck a blow for human justice," Morrell told the assembled dignitaries, "that cannot and will not pass away." It would take another generation to judge whether this was true. Chapter 18. Victory. Both in Africa and Europe, Leopold's death had promised to mark the end of an era. Many Belgians felt relieved. At last they would be rid of the multiple embarrassments of his youthful mistress, his unseemly quarrels with his daughters, and the sheer nakedness of his greed. But it was soon clear that Leopold's ghost would not vanish so easily. The king who had died while in possession of one of Europe's largest fortunes had tried to take it with him. After a fashion, he had succeeded. Not long before his death, it turned out, Leopold had surreptitiously ordered the establishment of a foundation, based in Germany, to which he transferred some 25 million francs worth of paintings, silverware, crystal, jewellery, furniture, and the like, plus another 20 million francs in securities. Some of the foundation's income was to be reinvested, its charter said, and the remainder was to be spent, according to the directions left by the founder, on the grand, showy projects he loved—palaces, monuments, and public buildings. He was afraid that future small-minded Belgian governments would not spend money in such ways, and he was also trying, as always, to keep his wealth from going to Louise, Stephanie, and Clementine. "The king has but two dreams," a former cabinet minister reportedly said during Leopold's last years, "to die a billionaire and to disinherit his daughters." The German foundation was not the only place Leopold had tried to hide his fortune. 58 pieces of real estate in Brussels, purchased for the king by his faithful aide Baron Auguste Coffinet, turned out to belong to another secret company. A third shadowy entity, the Residential and Garden Real Estate Corporation of the Côte d'Azur, held possession of Leopold's panoply of Riviera properties. Some of these villas were earmarked as permanent vacation homes for future Belgian kings. Others were to be part of a huge health resort, with parks, gardens, sports facilities, and cottages, providing free holidays for white officials returning from their labours in the Congo. Furthermore, these several corporate hiding places held more than 25 million francs worth of Leopold's Congo bonds. The Belgian government's effort to clear up the dead king's financial morass dragged on for years. Since the entities involved had been variously incorporated in Belgium, France, and Germany, the process of straightening everything out was wholly disrupted by World War I. The health resort was never built. The grand World School of Colonialism, which Leopold had enthusiastically planned, was left unfinished, its lavish foundations already laid outside Brussels. Somerset Maugham eventually bought one of the king's many Riviera villas. The grounds of another were turned into a zoo, known today for its troop of performing chimpanzees. Only in 1923, 14 years after his death, was the last of Leopold's financial thicket untangled. Investigators trying to figure out his finances discovered, among other things, that some of the riches he had disposed of had in fact belonged to his crazed sister, Carlotta, still very much alive. Leopold, her legal guardian, had helped himself to certain properties of hers that he wanted, illegally substituting for them some of his Congo state bonds. The one-time Empress of Mexico long outlived her brother. When she received a visitor, it was in a room with 20 or more chairs lined up. Carlotta would enter the room and solemnly greet an imaginary guest in each chair before talking with her caller. As the years passed, she spent endless hours changing her clothes and doing her hair. Then, one day, she reportedly caught sight of herself in a mirror, realized that she was no longer a youthful beauty, and ordered all the mirrors in her chateau smashed. At a party 45 years after her husband's execution, she exclaimed, puzzled, "And Maximilian isn't here." She was probably one of the few people in Belgium who barely noticed the 4-year German occupation during World War I. She died in 1927 at the age of 86, muttering madly about imaginary kingdoms and dynasties to the very end. Even today, researchers are not completely sure which of Leopold's baubles were paid for out of which hidden pockets. Nor is it possible to answer fully a larger question: how much profit altogether did the king draw from the Congo in his lifetime? In answer to this question, the Belgian scholar Jules Marchal, the leading historian of this period, makes a conservative estimate, not including some smaller or hard-to-trace sources of money, of 220 million francs of the time, or $1.1 billion in today's dollars. One of the lawsuits provoked by Leopold's financial tangles was filed by Princesses Stephanie and Louise. They claimed that since the wealth in the secret foundation and companies had been their father's, it was now in part theirs. The Belgian government, however, eventually got most of the funds. There was no lawyer to argue that the money should have been returned to the Congolese. The final meeting of the Congo Reform Association in 1913 marked the end of the most important and sustained crusade of its sort between the abolitionism of the early and middle 19th century and the worldwide boycott and embargo against apartheid-era South Africa in the 1970s and 1980s. But the Congo Reform Movement, heroic though it was, leaves some troubling questions in its wake. The most important is, did it do any lasting good? For many years, the conventional answer was yes. The glare of publicity surrounding the casement and commission of inquiry investigations had sparked a new outbreak of rebellions in some areas that caused a noticeable, although temporary, reduction of rubber gathering. Later, E.D. Morel and his allies could point to the marked drop-off in reports of atrocities after the transfer to Belgium. Oblique testimony to the importance of wresting the Congo away from Leopold came even from Alexandre Delcommune, a long-time Congo businessman and administrator, a ruthless robber baron. It was a steamboat from Delcommune's company that Joseph Conrad was hired to command. Delcommune once wrote that if Leopold's rule had lasted another 10 years, one would no longer have found a single rubber vine, or perhaps a single native. Did the Congo reformers then save millions of lives? It would be a fitting climax to our story if this were so, for a splendid movement deserves splendid results. The organizing by E.D. Morel, the acts of witness of George Washington Williams, William Shepherd, and Roger Casement, and the deaths of Andrew Shanu and of rebel leaders like Nzanzu, Mulume Nyama, and Kandolo should not have been in vain. But the truth is more somber. Reports of abuses against gatherers of wild rubber in the Congo did drop off markedly after the Belgian takeover of 1908. In the following years, there was far less news of villages burned or of women and children held hostage. There was no more officially sanctioned severing of hands. What lay behind the change, however, was not a kinder and gentler regime brought about by the reformers, but several other developments. One was the gradual shift from wild rubber to cultivated rubber. Another was the introduction of a new method of forcing people to work that drew much less protest from missionaries and humanitarians. Taxes. The Belgian administrators who took over from Leopold saw that they needed plantations of cultivated rubber, because if all the rubber harvested came from wild vines, Africans desperate to meet their quotas would cut them all down. Vines were already becoming scarce in parts of the country. Look again at the statement from Alexandre Delcommune. He sounds just as concerned about the possible disappearance of wild rubber as of Congolese. The imposition of a heavy head tax forced people to go to work on the plantations or in harvesting cotton, palm oil, and other products, and proved an effective means of continuing to collect some wild rubber as well. Until the 1920s, white traders bought wild rubber from villagers pressed to pay their taxes. The central part of what Morel had called the system, forced labour, remained in place, applied to all kinds of work. Forced labour became particularly brutal during the First World War. In 1916, an expanded force publique invaded German East Africa, today's Tanzania. Like the other Allied powers, Belgium had its eye on getting part of Germany's slice of the African cake in the post-war division of the spoils. Enormous numbers of Congolese were conscripted as soldiers or porters. Enormous numbers of Congolese were conscripted as soldiers or porters. In 1916, by colonial officials' count, One area in the eastern Congo, with a population of 83,518 adult men, supplied more than 3 million man-days of porterage during the year. 1,359 of these porters were worked to death or died of disease. Famines raged. A Catholic missionary reported, "The father of the family is at the front, the mother is grinding flour for the soldiers, and the children are carrying the foodstuffs." The years after the war saw the growth of copper, gold, and tin mining. As always, the profits flowed out of the territory. It was legal for mine management to use the Chicot, and at the gold mines of Moto on the Upper Uele River, records show that 26,579 lashes were administered in the first half of 1920 alone. This figure was equal to 8 lashes per full-time African worker. Techniques for gathering forced labor for the mines were little different from those employed in Leopold's time. According to the historian David Northrup, a recruiter from the mines went around to each village chief, accompanied by soldiers or the mine's own policeman, presented him with presents, and assigned him a quota of men, usually double the number needed since half normally deserted as soon as they could. The chief then rounded up those he liked the least, or feared, or who were least able to resist, and sent them to the administrative post tied together by the neck. From there they were sent on to the district headquarters in chains. Chiefs were paid 10 francs for each recruit. If a worker fled, a member of his family could be imprisoned. Not so different from the old hostage system. As elsewhere in Africa, safety conditions in the mines were abysmal. In the copper mines and smelters of Katanga, 5,000 workers died between 1911 and 1918. When the vaunted Matadi-Leopoldville Railroad was rebuilt with a wider gauge and partly new route by forced labor between 1921 and 1931, more workmen on the project perished than had died when the line was laid in the 1890s. To the Africans throughout the Congo conscripted to work on these and other new enterprises, the Great Depression, paradoxically, brought life-saving relief. With the start of the Second World War, the legal maximum for forced labor in the Congo was increased to 120 days per man per year. More than 80% of the uranium in the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombs came from the heavily guarded Congo mine of Shinkolobwe. The Allies also wanted ever more rubber for the tires of hundreds of thousands of military trucks, jeeps, and warplanes. Some of the rubber came from the Congo's new plantations of cultivated rubber trees. But in the villages, Africans were forced to go into the rainforest, sometimes for weeks at a time, to search for wild vines once again. Although they failed to end forced labor, the Congo reformers for roughly a decade were spectacularly successful in keeping the territory in the spotlight. Seldom has so much outrage poured down for so long upon such a distant target. This raises another major question about the movement. Why the Congo? An ancient English law made it a crime to witness a murder or discover a corpse and not raise a hue and cry. But we live in a world of corpses, and only about some of them is there a hue and cry. True, with a population loss estimated at 10 million people, what happened in the Congo could reasonably be called the most murderous part of the European scramble for Africa. But that is so only if you look at sub-Saharan Africa as the arbitrary checkerboard formed by colonial boundaries. If you draw boundaries differently, to surround, say, all African equatorial rainforest land rich in wild rubber, then what happened in the Congo is, unfortunately, no worse than what happened in neighboring colonies. Leopold simply had far more of the rubber territory than anyone else. Within a decade of his head start, similar forced labor systems for extracting rubber were in place in the French territories west and north of the Congo River, in Portuguese-ruled Angola, and in the nearby Cameroons under the Germans. For the concession companies in the Cameroons, the model from which they professed to derive their inspiration, writes one historian, was that of King Leopold II's ventures in the Congo Free State, the dividends of which evoked admiration in stockbroking circles. In France's equatorial African territories, where the region's history is best documented, the amount of rubber-bearing land was far less than what Leopold controlled, but the rape was just as brutal. Almost all exploitable land was divided among concession companies. Forced labor, hostages, slave chains, starving porters, burned villages, paramilitary company sentries, and the Chicot were the order of the day. Thousands of refugees who had fled across the Congo River to escape Leopold's regime eventually fled back to escape the French. The population loss in the rubber-rich equatorial rainforest owned by France is estimated, just as in Leopold's Congo, at roughly 50%. And, as in Leopold's colony, both the French territories and the German Cameroons were racked by long, fierce rebellions against the rubber regime. The French scholar, Catherine Coquerie-Vidrovitch, has published a chilling graph showing how, at one French Congo post, Salanga, between 1904 and 1907, the month-by-month rise and fall in rubber production correlated almost exactly to the rise and fall in the number of bullets used up by company sentries, nearly 400 in a busy month. During this period, a scandal erupted in France when two white men were put